Oh, thanks, but no thanks, Steve. But thank you for your generous introduction and for the opportunity, the invitation to once again occupy this platform, one which I've enjoyed many times before. This being a forecasting conference, you will, of course, spend much of your time contemplating economic forecasts for the year ahead. We put out our own views on that a few weeks back, and I don't propose to canvass tonight changes to that set of forecasts. What I would like to do is to return to a theme that I've spoken about before, and that is the nature and use of economic forecasts for policy purposes. I'm going to need a bottle opener here at some point so that I have adequate liquidity. we wouldn't want it to dry up. But there have been some important points, I think, to illustrate from forecasting experience in recent years and the way economic policy has been conducted. Thank you. Now, to begin with, though, I'd like to draw some observations from another kind of forecast. As some of you may know, I do a bit of aviation in my spare time. And so I've become a rather serious user of weather forecasts. And there are very detailed forecasts prepared for the aviation community that help to make flying both more predictable and safer. So I want to take an example from such a forecast and draw out a couple of points of principle that I think there is some value for us in thinking about economic forecasts. Well, a couple of months ago, a pilot that I know had planned to fly in a light aircraft from Bankstown in Sydney's west to Armidale. That's about 90 minutes north, 90 minutes flight time, pick up some people and fly back to Bankstown. I'm going to show you now slides very different to what you will have seen any time in the past at a forecasting conference. This is what we call a TAF, Terminal Area Forecast, for the two airports on the day in question, which was 25 September this year. This is what you get if you go to the relevant dedicated website and look up the relevant forecast. So it's kind of coded, so let me decode it for you. All Australian airports have a four-letter code. They all start with a Y in Australia. In America, they start with a K. In Europe, they start with an E, but ours start with Y. In the Sydney region, the next letter's an S, and then BK's for Bankstown, obviously. If we had Sydney here, it would be YSSY. The next line tells you what the wind was forecast to be. 150 degrees, 15 knots, gusting to 25 knots. That's actually quite a bit of wind. The 9999 is the visibility in metres, so 10 kilometres of visibility. Showers of rain forecast. The next line was few clouds, that's covering a quarter of the sky. At 1,200 feet, scattered cloud at 2,000, broken, which is covering most of the sky, 3,000 feet. That's all okay. The next line says that there would be temporary periods on the 25th between 00 hours Greenwich time, that's 10 o'clock in the morning here, until 4 o'clock in the afternoon, where the visibility would go down to 3 kilometres, which is not very much when you're doing 2 or 3 kilometres a minute. That's not much visibility. Showers of rain, cloud broken at 800 feet, which is very low. What all that means is conditions for a landing back into that airport would be quite marginal during those temporary periods, which could be up to an hour. And the requirement that comes from that is you have to carry fuel to circle for a while waiting for the weather to improve. You need an hour's worth of holding fuel. The forecast for Armidale was southerly wind, likewise rain, intermittent periods of low visibility and showers with low cloud. And the significant thing here is the next line, prob 30, that means a 30% probability, intermittent periods where the wind would be 20 knots gusting to 30, 3 kilometres of visibility in thunderstorms at the airport with scattered cumulonimbus clouds. They're those big towering clouds that you get with storms. The base is 4,500 feet and the top of that cloud would be 30 or 40,000 feet. So that was the forecast on the day. It was a day actually rather like today. If you got today's forecast, it would look quite similar to this. Cruddy weather, wet, windy, low cloud, not very nice, and certainly complicates aviation. The route between these two points goes along the Great Divide, which means there's high terrain and that also complicates weather, and there were forecast to be storms en route as well as in Armidale. At the intended time of departure, the weather in Sydney was at least as bad as forecast, and there were actually storms in Armidale at that time. Storms are very dangerous because you get wind shear near the ground, heavy rain, hail. It's extremely dangerous to land in those conditions, and even large aircraft wait for such weather to pass from the airport. So these were difficult conditions. It would have been legal to commence this flight under the instrument flight rules, provided you carried the additional fuel needed, appropriately trained and so on. Professional pilots would encounter this sort of thing not every day, but often enough. Today they would have encountered something very like this. And for people who fly professionally in a multi-crew aircraft that's high performance, they would regard handling this as routine, if a bit tedious. The main question for the pilot on the 25th of September was, for an amateur pilot flying a light aircraft in a single pilot operation under these conditions, was it prudent to go or not? Well, in the event the pilot in question decided that day to stay on the ground, go home for lunch rather than go flying, and the people that he was due to pick up got on a commercial carrier and safely made their way to Sydney. So what's the point of this little diversion into my hobby? Well, I think there are a few things about these forecasts that are of some value, and I want to talk about that. The first one is that the weather forecasters had understood what I would call the big forces at work. Actually, I do have one more slide, and this is the what's called the mean sea level pressure analysis chart for that day. There was a high pressure system over Tasmania and a low off the northeast coast of New South Wales, and that produced a southeasterly airstream that picks up the moisture from the Tasman Sea and dumps it over the southeast part of the continent, and that's where all the rain and cloud comes from. In fact, I had a look at today's chart and it looks very like this. The high pressure system is still a bit to the left of Tasmania right now, but it's coming our way. So cruddy weather for a few days, I suspect. But I'm not here to make a weather forecast. But the point is, the meteorologists understood the big forces at work. In fact, meteorologists know a lot about how weather works. They have long-time series of observations. They have real-time observations, many of them from around the country these days. They have very highly developed non-linear models. And so a combination of well-developed models, a lot of data, real-time observation and experience enabled them to get the really big picture right and to give a very useful forecast for those who were planning on venturing into the sky that day. The second point of note is that some of the forecasts were expressed in a probabilistic way. So that prob 30 line, 30% probability of a storm. Weather forecasters know that they deal with very complex non-linear phenomena, and they're careful to present certain elements of their forecasts appropriately. They are able to observe the unstable atmospheric conditions which produce storms, and that's basically heat and moisture. If you get enough of those together, quite likely get a thunderstorm. And there's some role played by the terrain as well. So they can't say that there definitely will be a storm over Armidale or any other point that day, but they know enough to assess a probability and tell the pilot that he needs to take certain precautions. And there would definitely have been storms somewhere along that route that day to avoid. So I think those are quite useful features of these forecasts. The third observation that I have is that in aviation, forecasts are used in particular ways, or they're used in particular ways in any field, but in aviation, the way you use the forecast is designed to save your life, basically. Professional pilots in large aeroplanes that fly above most of the weather still study the forecast, and they make the requisite amendments to their plans that the forecast dictates. They carry additional fuel if needed. They have an alternate, a plan B for another place to go if they can't land, and so on, all driven by what the forecast is telling them. Many of you will have had the experience of not being able to land in Canberra in winter in the morning because of the fog, and the plane has to go back to Sydney or circle for a while waiting for the fog to clear or whatever. Very occasionally we have international flights into Sydney that end up in Melbourne or Brisbane because Sydney has fog, and they will have had to carry the additional fuel to get there, dictated by the forecast. And actually that isn't trivial. If you've come all the way across the Pacific to carry 8 or 10 tonnes of extra fuel for a 747 to get an hour away to Melbourne, if you can't land in Sydney, that actually costs you quite a bit to do, because it costs fuel to carry fuel. Despite all the criticism leveled at weather forecasts, I've personally, as an amateur pilot, found them actually pretty good in the aviation sphere. And I think the saying that economic forecasts are there to make the weather forecasters look good has something going for it. Of course, there is one big difference in economic forecasting, which is that some decisions which the forecast may prompt, like an economic policy decision, for example, may actually change the outcome, whereas our response to a weather forecast won't, in fact, change the weather. So that makes economic forecasting harder. Still, as I say, I think some of these features of weather forecasts are of some value. Key among them, as I've said, is a sense of what the big forces are, so that you've got, you know, the whole sort of southeastern pressure situation in the weather forecast drives the forecast for the various regions. We in the economic sphere need a good understanding of the big forces at work, as well as the dynamics of how the economy may respond to them. In addition, I think we should admit that economic forecasts have a margin of error. Mostly what most of us as economic forecasters are producing is really a point estimate in a distribution of possible outcomes. On that point, I think a lot is often made of small changes to forecasts, or differences between forecasts, the RBA and Treasury, just to pick two at random. But when consideration is given to the real extent of margin for error around central forecasts, most of the time these differences are, for practical purposes, insignificant. Steve was unkind enough to refer back to David's forecast of the terms of trade, and you know, we had forecasts similar to that. I think we finally have reached the peak now, but some years after the initial prediction of it. But let's take GDP. in our experience, going back through our forecasts over a run of years, for a four-quarter end of GDP growth forecast 1 year ahead, the probability of the forecast being accurate to within half a percentage point either side is about one in five. For year average forecasts, like the ones that typically are released with the budget, the accuracy is better because that's an inherently smoother aggregate, but still, forecast errors are non-trivial. So if the likelihood of being plus or minus a half is one in five, then the likelihood of some other outcome than the central forecast is actually very high. It's 80%. So when we're comparing forecasts, if we're not talking about half a percentage point at least of difference, then, you know, it isn't really worth having the argument. In any event, the question isn't really whether the forecast turns out to be exactly right. The question is whether the forecast forms a reasonable basis for sensible analysis or decisions at the time it's made. And when it turns out not to be exactly right, which it almost certainly will, that's really not much of a basis on which to criticise the people who used the forecast, or for that matter, the people who made it, because the nature and the science of forecasting here is that that's just how it is. Well, for monetary policy, naturally, we're operating a medium-term inflation target. We're interested in forecasting capacity for inflation. Experience over the inflation targeting era, which is 18 years now, since 1993, suggests that the probability of the CPI outcome, headline CPI, being within half a percentage point of the central forecast is roughly 2 in 5, 40%. Over a one-year or a two-year horizon. So it's better than for GDP, but still it's only two chances in five. For underlying inflation, the probability of being within half a percentage point is about two in three at 1 year and just over one half at 2 years. Now, underlying inflation, of course, is more stable. That's the way it was designed as a measure, so it's not surprising that the forecasting errors are a bit smaller. So if our central forecast was, say, 2.5%, which it is right now, the chances of the outcome being between 2 and 3%, which would appear to be, in my view, fairly significant numbers, based on that historical experience, the chances of that outcome, if the central forecast is 2.5%, is about 40%. The chances of being of the outcome being between 1.5% and 3.5%, that is one percentage point either side of the midpoint of the target zone, would be about 3 in 5. Well, I think that, just in passing, that if that is a reasonable description of forecasting accuracy, then I think it means that the configuration of the inflation target that we have is a pretty reasonable one, given our ability to forecast. I'd hasten to add that when we first started articulating this forecast nearly 20 years ago, we did not really have all that much confidence in our ability to do accurate forecasts. But as it turns out, I think the formulation we hit upon was probably a pretty reasonable one. So it would, in my judgment, be preferable for discussions of forecasts to be couched in more probabilistic language than tends usually to be the case. Usually the case is that people want to know what's the number, and that actually is not quite the right question. There needs to be more explicit recognition of the real margin for uncertainty, and I think more explicit recognition that the figures that people write down are conditional on various assumptions, a number of which are very important. Now, careful observers may have noted that the latest forecasts that the bank published actually have a range for growth and inflation, certainly at the end of the horizon. And we do these days try to have more extensive discussion of the ways in which things could turn out differently to the central forecast, and we're more explicit about the various working assumptions we make, like oil prices, exchange rates, even interest rates. So we're trying there to recognise the inherent uncertainties in this process, and I think that's important. I think it's also important to think about how particular numerical forecasts are used in the policy process. So I'm going to come to that in a moment. Taking account of these accuracy statistics, though, that I've quoted, I think we could characterise our latest published forecasts as saying that, absent large shocks to oil prices or the exchange rate or further weather events like we saw last summer, or the world economy going in the tank, say, because of Europe or whatever, then Australia's inflation rate in 2012 has a pretty good chance of being between 2 and 3%. The chances of a similar outcome in the following year are also reasonable, though the probability of being above 3 is a little higher in that year. That is to say, the central tendency forecast is a bit higher. Even so, a margin of uncertainty is considerable, and any big change in any of the variables subject to assumption could quite easily push outcomes away from, and maybe quite a long way away from, those central estimates. That degree of uncertainty, of course, is quite disconcerting to most of us, and I'm sure to the ordinary person in the street, because we want certainty. We want to believe that somebody... We all want to know what will happen, and we want to believe that someone does know, and if we can just find them and ask them, then they can tell us what to expect. The truth, unfortunately, is that the best we can do when talking about the future is to speak about likelihoods and possible alternative outcomes, but not speak about certainties, or not speak as though we were certain. Lest you think that's a counsel of despair, I don't think it is, because it's not as though we can say nothing about the future. We know something about the economy's average rate of growth through time. We know what determines that: productivity growth and population growth. We don't know everything about how they will behave, but we know some things about what's going on. We know that there have been in the past and will be again episodes of recession and recovery, though we also know that our capacity to forecast the timing of that accurately is not good. We know from experience things about the behaviour of inflation. It has a lot of inertia. And we know what sort of things make it go up or down. And we know at the moment some of the what I'd call big forces at work. We know we're having, as you heard this afternoon, a once-in-a-century terms of trade event. We know that we're having, in a number of other countries, probably a once-in-a-century deleveraging event. We know that our country's exposed to both those, actually. Obviously, the terms of trade story is very expansionary. We're having a mild version of deleveraging in our households, and we're probably indirectly affected by the more severe deleveraging going on in some other countries. We also know that the terms of trade change is fundamentally a shift in relative prices, a very large one, which will unavoidably bring changes to the structure of the economy. So there's a lot we can say about the things that are happening and likely to happen. And I think economists' understanding of these things is important and will be helpful in explaining what and making sense of the things that occur. It's just that we have to recognise the limits of our capacity to be precise in working out what the net effect of these very large forces is. Well, that in turn has implications for the way policymakers use numerical forecasts, so let me talk about that. In the case of monetary policy, unavoidably, we have to use forecasts for the simple reason that all the evidence is that policy changes take time, sometimes quite a long time, to have their full impact. So you have to look ahead. So we have to use forecasts, but not unquestioningly. We have to form a view about the big forces at work, as I've said, but also work with due recognition of the limitations of numerical forecasts. and the extent to which forecasters, to which policymakers respond to numerical forecasts, I think inevitably is always going to involve a certain degree of judgment. And I think that's been illustrated over the past few years. Through that time, through much of the episodes that Stephen talked about in his introduction, the bank's view of what we thought the big forces were that were at work has been central. Policy was tight in a period when the economy was very fully employed, confidence was very high, leverage was still increasing, terms of trade were rising, inflation was going up. Then there was a very large and very rapid easing of monetary policy late in 2008 and early into the following year, because the big forces changed course very quickly due to the financial shocks that happened at that time. That saw the strong growth of Asia go very quickly into retreat. It saw appetite for risk go right down, willingness to lend sharply curtailed, and confidence slump. The changes in policy beginning in the latter part of 2009, the back to normal phase, well, that occurred when it had become clear, in our view, that the risk of a really big contraction in Australia had passed. In fact, at that point, the big forces in an expansionary direction had well and truly asserted themselves after an unexpectedly short absence, I might say. Resurgent Asian growth helped to push the terms of trade to new highs, as we've been hearing. And in that world, our view was leaving interest rates at a 50-year low would have been imprudent, so we didn't do that. Over the past 18 months, there's been considerably less activism on our part, though I would say the process of decision-making has nonetheless not been dull. A year ago, the current data at that stage on inflation didn't show anything alarming, but the staff forecast that we had suggested that the fall in inflation we'd been seeing for a couple of years would probably end, and most likely inflation would start to go up again, albeit quite gradually. The board took the view then that, given that outlook and given the circumstances as they were at that time, it would be prudent for policy to exert a mild degree of restraint, and so we decided to raise the cash rate 25 basis points. And as we know, that was turned into slightly bigger easing by banks adding a bit on top of that. While the inflation data for the first half of this year do indeed show some pickup in inflation, though after a sequence of revisions, that pickup's not quite as large as it looked a few months ago. As of May this year, the central forecast was for inflation to pick up further over the ensuing year or two, eventually rising to be clearly in excess of 3%. While for an inflation-targeting central bank, that forecast per se carried a fairly obvious message. And as we said in May, and I quote, "The central outlook sketched above suggests that further tightening of monetary policy is likely to be required at some point for inflation to remain consistent with the 2 to 3% medium-term target," unquote. There was, though, still a matter of judging how you respond to that message. That's the message the forecasters were giving us. One saw no particular reason to think that there was anything wrong with that forecast, but you have to decide then what you're going to do with it. The board did not tighten policy at that time, nor did it do so 3 months later when new data and new forecasts still said that things looked the way they had back in May. It's true, and it's a matter of public record, that the board did consider whether further tightening should be done, but in the event elected to sit still, watching various things that were going on. And eventually, last month, far from tightening, the board actually eased policy slightly, though, of course, by then, the forecasts and the facts had changed quite materially from those of 6 months earlier. Now, that behaviour by the policymakers was not a repudiation of the forecasts, nor a sign that they regard the forecasts as not useful. The process of making forecasts remains central to the conduct of policy. In electing to take time considering their response to a particular set of forecasts, signs of an increase in inflation are forecasts that may go further, the policymakers were simply recognising the inherent difficulties the forecasters face, the uncertainties of the situation, and giving due weight to those considerations. Now, I think myself that it's entirely appropriate that there be that limited degree of discretion for the policymakers in responding to changes in numerical forecasts. It isn't that the forecast should be ignored at all, but neither, I think, should the decision be rigidly and mechanically linked to the forecasts. If it was, then the policymakers really would have delegated the decision to the forecasters. And while I have the utmost admiration for our forecasters and the rest of you out there as well, that actually is not what the policymakers are supposed to do. So the relationship between the written down numbers in the forecasts and the policy decision sometimes is going to be a subtle one. Ultimately, the policymakers have to make a judgment call. That's their job. And that's going to be based partly on what the central forecast says, but also it's going to be conditioned by the degree of confidence they have in that forecast and their sense of the broader picture. That said, I think it's important to emphasise that policymakers can only be in a position to exercise the kind of judgments that we have this year if they've generally acted in a timely and forward-looking way in a whole sequence of earlier decisions, which I believe we did. So in my view, and of course I would say this, but in my view, those judgments over the past year were the right calls. Of course, the truth is we can't really know for sure yet, and we won't for a while, because that's the nature of the policy process with all the lags that are inherent in it. As always, more data will help the process of evaluation, though more data might also provide evidence of shocks that are new, things that the forecasters couldn't predict, and that's just the nature of the forecasting game. So in conclusion, ladies and gentlemen, to those of you here who don't have to make forecasts, I hope you realise how fortunate you are. To those who do, I offer my sympathy, and I certainly offer my heartfelt best wishes for clear vision over the year ahead. Thanks for your attention.
Lewis South from Optimix. Glenn, always a pleasure to listen to you speak. I always learn something today. I learned about weather forecasting, and I thought I'd throw something back at you in line with that. And that question was, actually, I've got two questions. The first one is, it strikes me you talked about the range of forecasts, and there are central banks around the globe that do that, particularly the Bank of England, and do it reasonably successfully. I wouldn't say any better than what the Reserve Bank does it in terms of guiding the markets and expectations, but it's certainly an alternative where they do give a probabilistic range. Is that something that the Reserve Bank is thinking about? And my second question, in line with the weather forecast that you ran through, is, in your mind, what is the probability of a severe thunderstorm hitting the Australian economy from a very severe low in Europe that would cause the Reserve Bank to maybe push interest rates down to the ground?
Well, let's come at those one by one. I don't think we're going to be doing rivers of blood and rivers of bile, as they're called, that is fan charts, ourselves. Actually, there's a fair bit of technical sophistication in, you know, dividing the deciles in the distribution. I myself am not confident that I'd know quite where to put those points. But I do think the Bank of England, and it was, I think, when Sir Mervyn King was the chief economist, that they started to emphasise the probabilistic nature of the future, and I think they did the forecasting community a service in doing that. So I don't think we'll be doing fan charts per se, but we're, at least on my own part, trying to grapple with the notion that there's at least some margin of uncertainty, and the margin of uncertainty in truth might be even a bit wider than the range we've written down. On the probability, what's the number of probability of a severe storm from Europe? Well, unfortunately, it's not zero. I think the events, as they say in Europe, are dire but not serious, as the old joke goes. They are pretty serious. And I think we are fast coming to the point where all the parties who have a role to play in getting to the solution there really have to hurry up and do it. And otherwise the probability of damage to not just us but everyone will be unacceptably high. So I'm not going to put a figure on the probability, but the probability right now is probably higher than we would like, and it would be good if someone could get it to go down, unlike what you can do with the weather, of course, because that you just have to take as given. Thank you. Rory.
Rory my old staff Westpac Treasury. You mentioned that you've had a year of mostly masterful inaction, so congratulations on that. And
Whether everyone agrees it was masterful, I don't know, but anyhow.
Two questions. You can guess the second one, but at least I'll try and ask it in a relevant way. The first one...
No comment, I'll tell you now. Ask away.
The first one is, would it be possible over time at least, since the bank seems to insist on moving every Melbourne Cup day, is it possible to move that to either the first Monday of November or the first Wednesday perhaps?
Second question.
Second question. You won't be that interested in either. But in August, the Reserve Bank published forecasts of underlying inflation that had inflation basically running close to 3% as far as the eye can see. In 3 months later, just earlier this month, the new forecast was 2.5% as far as the eye can see. So a downshift of half a percentage point in the inflation forecast. That was quickly followed by a quarter point cut in the cash rate. My question is, are we overdue, given the half percentage point reduction in inflation forecast and only a quarter percent cut in the cash rate, are we overdue for another quarter point cut?
Nice try. Would you like it on Melbourne Cup Day, Nick?
Or is it the case that the Australian economy is actually in reasonable shape? Yeah. And David Gruen had a great chart this afternoon showing the downtrend in unemployment and the downtrend in the variability of unemployment across, I think it was 1,400 separate areas in Australia, that actually the economy is in far better shape than most people seem to give it credit for. Thanks.
Well, I think the economy is travelling... it's travelling okay. I think... the forecast changes, you didn't mention the changes to the growth forecast, but they were also revised. Some of that is because the coal pits have still got some water. Some cases, I think that's still even true now. Here we are in November. I think there's probably still some dewatering going on. And that's been slower. The non-mining economy has been a bit softer. The global outlook, even if you don't think Europe is going to go seriously south, the global outlook's come down, and it's rational enough, I think, for the inflation forecast to respond to that, as well as to the actual facts of the most recent release and the revisions. I think... In your analysis of comparing the extent of revision to inflation and the change in the interest rate, of course, the bit you skipped was that I think we were widely interpreted as having a bias to probably tighten further at some point, and we went from that to actually easing. So there's a couple of steps gone on there. I'm not going to come obviously at where to, if anywhere, from here. That would preempt future decisions of the board, and it's not appropriate to do that. On Melbourne Cup Day, I'm tempted to say that the Melbourne Cup will change day before the RBA board, but that's probably a bit extreme, but it's been on that day for at least 30 years now, and it's actually pretty hard to make changes to the date with our board members who are on very busy schedules. So on one or two occasions when I've wondered whether we could do that, it was all too hard. So I can't see us changing, which isn't, of course, a guarantee that there'll be a move every time. Past performance is not necessarily a guarantee of future performance, as you know.
We've got Bruce.
Bruce.
Hey, Glenn. I suppose I need to get this question in before anybody else asks it. This talk was essentially around or focused and discussed the uncertainties around forecasts, but what role, too, does, in terms of the probabilities that you're assessing, the role of the uncertainties around the published data actually play?
Yeah, well, that's quite a good question, I think, because a lot of what central banks are all doing with their time is actually what some people call nowcasting. So, you know, what really is going on right now, and then we subsequently get GDP numbers that tell us whether we had any idea or not. Some central banks actually, the Bank of England, I'm not sure if they're still doing it, but they did actually at one point have a process of writing down their own version of the GDP accounts in history of what that's what we think was happening. You know, I kind of like that idea, actually. I like to do that for inflation, too, and I'd be writing down 2.5 all the time. But it is a working out what's happening right now, because that's the kicking off point for the outlook. It is a thing that we all spend a lot of time doing, and you know, if you haven't got some idea of where right now is, then the forecast isn't probably going to be much use. So, and there is a reasonable degree of uncertainty, I think, about that. Where are we right now? Yeah. David?
If there's some probability of stormy weather of some sort ahead, and that's influencing decisions for the bank to ease monetary policy slightly, does it matter if fiscal policy is moving somewhat in the other direction?
I'm not going to come at the so-called fiscal monetary trade-off today. The government's going to release MIEFO and their plans soon, I assume, and we'll all find out what the shape of fiscal policy is at that time. I'm not going to canvass that tonight, I don't think. Sorry.
I'm coming
up here. Justin.
Glenn, thank you very much, Mr. Stevens. A rhetorical question, which is not going to be a trick question about monetary policy, but more one about deeper thought.
I thought these were all trick questions.
Yeah, I'll try not to be. In fact, it's a question about the job we do ourselves. You painted a very good analogy of a pilot flying and using uncertain situations to try and find what would be the best decision with least regret. Mm. With these forecasts, the question I have, would the world and financial situation be in a better place if we as managers, risk managers, follow a policy of least regret? That is, follow the forecasts, look at the probabilities, and say, potentially, what was our risk outcome? Mm. And maybe we should behave in a way of, rather than risk-seeking and return-seeking, of also behaving of what happens if that storm comes and we crash.
Yeah, well, I think let me see if I can paraphrase that and turn it into something I can answer. I think I think for a period of time, both private financial markets, they were underpricing risk, and I think we have to say, as a global kind of policy-making community, including the central bankers, the bank supervisors, and I'm talking globally here more than Australia per se, people were insufficiently cognizant of the extent to which things could go wrong. There were people, and I've said this before, there were people who pointed out risks and dangers, and they couldn't say, a bit like the weather forecaster, they couldn't say the storm is going to be in the US subprime market in 2007. They could just say, the conditions for a storm seem to be here somehow, but I just can't tell you where and when. But I think generally everybody was too optimistic, too little attention given to the dangers of a lot of leverage when the Great Moderation, if it finished, which of course it did. So I think that probably shows yet again, as so many times in history, that a bit of conservatism and prudence is very important. And, if we take our own country, the conservative way that our policies were run here, more so than some others, I think, when the storm did come, it gave us more scope to respond. So that was the payoff, but you don't know how long it's going to be before you get to actually use that payoff. So, yeah, it's a useful analogy, it's the nature of things. I think if we thought that there'll never be another episode where people underestimate risk and are too confident and too leveraged, I think that'd be a triumph of hope over experience, frankly. It's not going to happen soon, but one day it will.
Andrew McManus, ANZ. Governor, you mentioned the mild deleveraging in the Australian economy with debt-to-income ratios similar to those of 2008. Does the RBA or yourself believe that the greatest risk to the Australian economy is still the leverage in the household sector, and therefore further RBA rate cuts may fuel the Australian consumer?
Well, I'm not going to come at the final part of your question there. I think we've had a fair bit to say, my colleagues and I, about the way to think about the household debt situation. And, there are risks there, but thus far the households are servicing that debt quite well. But I think the households themselves have drawn the conclusion that it would be good to get the debt down a bit, and that has been an important feature of their behaviour for a few years now, and I think that is wise on their part. I'm not sure I would say that household leverage is the greatest risk we face. I can think of some others coming from offshore that, in the near term at least, might pose a bigger near-term risk. But I think it is very sensible of our households to be on the track of strengthening the balance sheets, and I think they've made a fair bit of progress, actually. Rob? Okay. Yeah.
Jeff Harcourt, University of New South Wales. Can I preface my question by pointing out that John Hicks distinguished between snatchers and stickers in behaviour in imperfectly competitive markets. The snatchers went for short-term profits regardless. The stickers had in mind long-term profits. And I think that the behaviour of the banking sector and the non-banking sector all around the world is in the last 20 years or more has been very much snatching and not sticking. What I'd like to ask you, just in a general sense, has the Reserve Bank given any thought to designing carrots and sticks to encourage the financial and non-financial sectors to behave much more like cautious stickers than greedy snatchers?
Well, I've been heard to say more than once that we want the financial system to be the handmaiden of industry, not the masters of the universe. So I have some sympathy with the point you're making, I think. I think it's... there are certainly regulatory initiatives which are designed to make banks less leveraged. And these really matter much more for the large global banks, which many of which were very highly leveraged, not so much our own. There are reforms in remuneration. I'm not sure whether or not they've got that exactly right. I don't know enough about it, but the intention there is to try to lessen the short-termism in behaviour, at least partly through that channel. And I think, you know, in the case, certainly in the case of our own banks, the growth prospects and the likelihood of being seen as a kind of a growth stock, if you like, are considerably reduced in the world we're in now with more cautious households, and I think that's a good thing. So we may get more sticking, as you put it. Whether we'll get enough, I don't know. And I think probably the industry globally, the very large global banks are still adjusting to the new world, so we've probably got some way to go there in terms of mindset change. But it's a very important point you make. It's a very complex and difficult thing to do, to design the carrots and sticks exactly right to achieve it. But I think the regulatory community certainly is trying to do that.
Getting close to time, so Rob might be the last one.
Glenn, we've heard quite a bit of Rob Henderson from NAB. We've heard a little bit of talk about the aeroplanes coming down and storms in Europe and so on. It strikes me that the elephant in the room is really the impact that might have on Asia and what Asia might do about it. And I was remembering that you've recently invested more resources in analysing Asia and particularly China, and the bank I know has done a lot of work on it. So, I mean, I think it's important to understand what the potential response from the Chinese authorities would be. So, you know, my question is, you know, what's your judgment about to what extent China could offset a major downturn in Europe as a hypothetical situation, and therefore, you know, what the implications of that would be for Australia?
The channels of transmission between a bad outcome in Europe and Asia would include the trade side but also the financial side, and to a certain extent financial conditions are tightening for trading countries right now because of the difficulties that some key European banks who do a lot of trade financing have had in funding. So there are those dimensions. I think the answer to how much scope a country like China has to move in an expansionary direction, really that's going to hinge on how successfully they feel they've dealt with the inflation threat, which both ordinary goods and services inflation and asset values. I think they've made a lot of progress, certainly in the latter case, and I think probably now the evidence is mounting up that ordinary inflation has probably peaked. So I imagine their reaction is going to be conditioned by how confident they are of that, and I guess how big a threat they perceive from the other events that you mention. It certainly seems to me that If they are in a position to feel comfortable that the inflation threat's been dealt with, then they'll probably have ample scope for expansionary measures if needed, and that will be good for us, as it was 3 or 4 years ago. I think they might perhaps next time do the expansionary things differently, because there've been some bit of indigestion from some of the things that were done there back there. But I'd have thought they've got scope to do that if they can feel comfortable that the battle they've been fighting in the past couple of years is now completed. And that's ultimately their judgment, not mine, and I can't really tell you right now where their thinking is on that.
Thank you.
Looks like we're done, Steve. Yeah. Thanks.